folks. We are back on Flexic.com T-Talk Podcast. My name is Stefan Tedor, always is on this podcast. I'm with my usual co-host, Scott McLeod. How are you on the first snowfall in 2020?
A little sad, actually. Looked out the window. Actually, I didn't see it at first. I happened to look at my phone because I was looking at possibly maybe making a tea time later this week. And all of a sudden it showed snow for the next 60 minutes. And I'm like, no, that's got to be wrong. There's just no, that can't be happening. Then I look at the radar and I'm like, oh my God, it is happening. So, yeah, it's unfortunate. Unfortunately, we live in a northern climate up here in Canada. And, you know, for parts of the country, we can't golf all year. So it's just the way it is. Have to accept it. And hopefully it melts in the next couple of days. And maybe we still get a chance to get a nine or something in before it's all over.
Yeah, I haven't accepted the fact that I'm not going to Arizona or something this year. Like, I have accepted it. But mentally, I just haven't got there.
Yeah.
I ended up the other day. I'm a big bath guy. Let me get this out in the open. Big bath guy. It's my guilty pleasure. I'm open about it. I don't care. You can judge me, whatever. It's where I get me time, okay? And I was watching like golf videos from like people going on trips to like Arizona and the desert, and then you go down that rabbit hole on YouTube, and it's just like, this is the only warmth is this bathtub I am going to get for the next 6 months. Just brutal, brutal. I think this season, I think I've swung my last golf club outside for 2020. It's sad.
I played a scramble on the weekend, and then on Sunday, I don't know if you saw my sad little tweet, but as I said, I was starting the new sucky fall tradition, the packing away of the golf shorts, which yep. I've never done for a lot of years. And it's just the reality that, you know, probably not going to be traveling in the next little while. PGA show is not happening this year.
Did you shed a tear when you saw your khaki pants for the PGA show or what?
I'm not a khaki pants guy. I that said, you're right. You know, 42,000 people there, 31,000 are in light blue shirts and khaki pants. Definitely, they're all over the place. I have not worn them on my body for many, many years, thankfully. So,
But
it's unfortunate. The PGA Merchandise Show is going to be a virtual show this year. It usually happens in January in Orlando. So, you know, that was the inevitable, I think, for any of the trade shows and things that are happening these days. It's just, you know, it's just not a safe environment to do it. And unfortunately, it impacts golf. And it just means a little more time in the north, I guess.
Fair enough. Well, golf's still on TV as we speak. I'm just finished watching the NCAA championships going on right now, which was entertaining to watch. So slow. These, like, the coaches coming in, overreading everything. Yeah. I watched that one girl. She took 5 practice strokes before hitting her putt. 5. Like, that's too many. It's 2 to 3 too many. It was insane. And just standing over everything. There was like a backup for like 20 minutes. These guys are standing on the tee because they were doing the co-ed events at the same golf course out at East Lake. It was just so slow, super entertaining. And we do have the championship going on, I believe tomorrow is the semis today. So looking forward to watching that. By the time this comes out, you'll know who actually won. But, you know, that was on. And then the Zozo wrapped up this week. Tiger Woods did not come close to defending his title.
No. And I think it sort of played into exactly a little bit what we were talking about last week of the shape of Tiger, what we expected of him coming back. Same for Phil as well. These guys were, you know, sucky is really how to put it. I mean, not even close. I mean, you're talking being 25 strokes behind plus, not even in the mix. So, I mean, otherwise the golf was pretty good. I mean, I didn't watch all of it, but, they replayed the final round of the Zozo, I think about 17 times
right away. I love that finishes up and it's like, thank you for watching, at Sherwood National, whatever it's club. We'll, see you next week in Bermuda. And it's like, all right, we are here at the Sherwood. And it's like, what? Like, give me 10 minutes. Like let's, oh, it was so bad. But it was. You're right. It was on Monday as well. It was just, it kept coming up.
Yeah, I mean, I think I watched parts of the final round, you know, multiple times over. Didn't make it, you know, any better, I guess, in the end. But watching, you know, Patrick Cantlay finally getting his third win. This is a guy that everybody thought would have a million wins by now. Such a talented player. And
I was thinking only like 100,000, but.
Yeah. But nice to see him do it too with his coach, Jamie Mulligan, on the bag. And also, you know, he's a California guy. So for him to win in California was big for him as well. And I think it bodes well for, you know, as we head into a big major, which I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about on the show this week. But I think the other thing, you know, Tiger and Phil aside, JT, you know, he choked this away. I mean, he had a couple of shots during that final round that were just way right. Was fighting it the whole way, and he knew. You could tell right at the end there he was mad at himself on 18 because he knew it was in his grasp, and he can't give this up, not when he's got that opportunity.
No, but also just absolute trash of him afterwards to say it's hard to win without fans. Like, yeah, no, that's on you.
That's a bad excuse.
You choked it away. You are easily the best player in the world right now, but you choked it away, not because there wasn't, you know, Bob and Karen standing behind the tee there, sipping on their red wine, right? Like, get over it.
Yeah, and really for that event, I mean, you had more backyards that were there. You could actually hear spectators, which were the people that were, you know, over their fences or whatever. There's probably more than there has been for many events. So, yeah, I don't get what it's got to do with it. I know they all talk about momentum and stuff like that, but, you know, the NHL played in the bubble with, you know, no fans. And
the,
you know,
best team won.
Right. And I don't think players are blaming the fact that there's no fans for, you know, for losing or anything like that. I mean, I just don't get it.
Yeah, the best players are still there every single week. But this tournament and the previous week, I kind of liked the mix into the schedule. Different golf courses that we don't get to see. I assume they're going to try to get back to Asia next year. But yeah. I would definitely like to see Shadow Creek again. And it was weird. You didn't see anybody complaining about the scores the last couple weeks when they're at these super high-end golf courses that no one's seen before. No one brought up the scores, I noticed, which I thought was funny.
It is interesting, actually, yeah, because usually mostly people would be all over Twitter arguing the fact that, you know, these guys are destroying the golf courses and the scoring's too low or whatever, but
sure,
you're right.
Sherwood National, how is it ever going to recover from a minus 23 finish? Yeah, no, 100%. I agree with you. One thought, though, on Tiger and Phil before we wrap it up. Is this the last time we ever see them paired together, or is this actually going to become more of a common occurrence because there's probably a higher chance that they both fall down into, you know, bottoms of leaderboards if they even make the weekend? They got lucky that there was a no-cut event at this event this weekend.
Yeah, I would say, you know, even they were talking about their comments afterwards. They were talking about, you know, playing together and stuff like that. But, you know, Tiger's 5 years away from Champions Tour if he plays some of that. You're probably right. I mean, their schedules are probably going to start to get lighter and lighter. The odds of them playing together are going to be less unless it happens to be a ceremonial type thing where, you know, they get put together at a Masters or something like that. So you're right. Then the number of times that they could be together is probably diminished.
Yeah. Tiger Woods, Champions Tour, over under amount of tournaments he plays, 1.5.
Over how many years?
Forever. In his life. I'm setting up 1.5. I think it's a guarantee he gives them one. They'll probably like pay him a ton of money just to go out there, but like,
yeah.
1.5. What are you taking?
No, you know what? I'll take the over. I think he's going to play. He might play some of the majors. I mean, you got to remember, you know, 5 years from now, his kids are going to be a little bit older. They have an opportunity to see him. You know, he's going to be sitting around the house. What's he going to do? I mean, he's going to play limited amounts on the PGA Tour. It's hit and giggle on the PGA Tour Champions. He can just go out. You know, it's a corporate gig. Maybe he does it to help fluff up his design company at that point. Maybe he's trying to work some gigs that way. I would say he would play a very minimal amount out there, but, you know, possibly he plays the majors.
Fair enough. I didn't see it.
You're obviously on the other side of the fence.
I don't know if I am. I think it's actually the perfect number, though. I legit think it's perfect number. He could play zero. on the Champions Tour, and nobody would say. Again, he could get injured this week, and we could never see him play another golf tournament again with his past. But it's something to think about, and luckily we have five more years. However, you know, his game's not in a great place. Really weird. I thought because of how he's played, we would see him in Houston. I do wonder, and maybe this he won't ever say this. I do wonder if he thinks, hey, there's going to be fans there. I'm not risking that before going to the Masters, right? Well, like, Texas isn't in a great place, yeah, COVID-wise, right? Like, is
that's
it
a possibility?
Risk? Like,
he didn't mention in his press conference.
He's never going to. It would
no, he's
horrible.
Not going to. But he said, you know, he was going to make his decision in the next couple days. I mean, so we'll hear from them. He certainly didn't rule it out as far as going there. But you're right. That could be a factor that plays into it. Certainly. I mean,
I thought it got ruled out literally this morning. Mark Steinberg tweeting out that his agent basically through whoever saying he's not playing at the Houston Open.
Oh, maybe I didn't see that.
Journalist here?
I was listening. I was going off the press conferences and all the transcripts from last night, so I didn't get to this morning. I was doing other work. I knew Mickelson had ruled it out because obviously he was the same thing. He was not. He objected to it. He wasn't a big fan of having fans there.
No.
Now what's going to happen? Here's our lead in to Augusta. I mean, really?
Yeah.
Now, the next time. If that's the case, then the next time we're going to see a Tiger is going to be at Augusta National.
No, actually, I think he's going to go to Bermuda this week. Late show up at Bermuda. Which, speaking of which, I got word they were looking for a lot of caddies out there. So I did quick research. How much would it cost me, flight-wise, to get from Canada to Bermuda?
Normally, it's okay.
Okay, but right now, would have cost me $3,000 and 48 hours of travel.
Wow. Oh, wow.
And I was like, yeah, no, unless it's a top 10 player in the world, I don't think I'm making that trek. But yeah,
$720,000 first prize event, $4 million purse. Yeah,
not worth it. So that's probably it. We're going to talk about Bermuda, other than them having the worst trophy in the still, which can't wait to talk about that. I'll probably watch it. It is a full field event this week with huge, big name groups the feature group of Keith Mitchell, Hudson Swafford, and Aaron Wise, which that should get people out of bed and watching on golf TV, that's for sure. Oh, even Stuart Sink has made it into a feature group, so watch out for that in Bermuda. But yeah, let's talk a little bit about the Masters. Tiger obviously said he would not play the Houston Open unless his game was in good shape going into the Masters. He's now playing the Houston Open. His game does not look to be in good shape. That being said, nobody really expected him to win the Masters last year. And here we are. He knows the course better than anybody out there. Do you think we're underselling him going in?
I think probably a lot of people will certainly not be paying attention to him based on the weekend, but you're right. The experience there matters more than anything. And it matters on the greens. It's not about playing the golf course. He knows how to play the golf course. I mean, it's not a place that's dead tight. He can hit it lots of different places, as Mickelson knows, as Bryson knows. Mm-hmm. There's lots of different places that you can hit it on that golf course, but it's knowing the greens. This is a place where you cannot use a greens book. They're not available for Augusta National. So it takes So it takes that experience to know, and that's why rookies don't do well there. Mm-hmm. That's part of the reasoning is that, they don't have local caddies anymore. So you have to go there and try to learn those big surfaces in a short period of time. Very difficult to do. So, if there's a place that he could shine just like he did last year, even though his game does not look like it's in perfect form. He's a crafty guy. I mean, who knows what he was doing at Sherwood? I mean, did he want to play better? Yeah, but
maybe he was trying something. Yeah,
maybe he was practicing shots. He was testing some other equipment. Maybe the Zozo, despite the fact he's the defending champion, for him, it could be a throwaway event where he's like, he's peaking for the majors and he's trying to do stuff for that. So I would not be surprised to see him in the mix there. That said, I don't think he's going to win. But again, we talked about that. But it, again, it's a different kind of time of year as well. So it will be different there, as he mentioned, you know, no roars and no spectators. But again, should that really factor into it? Probably not.
No. The other things they will not be having is the par three contest. Wow, I'm so sad. And then they're doing split tees, which is the first time in, you know, unless it's basically going to rain or they right. need to get in early. They,
lack they of daylight, don't ever so they've got to do it.
I do like the College Game Day Live from Augusta National on Saturday. That's going to be interesting. I saw some funny tweets of people holding up Bryson signs in the background going crazy. That'll be interesting. And then also My Group will allow fans to set up featured groups and view every shot of their favorite players. Now this... Yep. I cannot wait to see. That is going yep. to be amazing. That changes the watching experience completely for anybody. Because now you actually get to watch. There can't be any complaints at the yep. end of the week of like, hey, we didn't get to see any golf shots. Now you got to see every shot you wanted to.
Yeah, they had a variation of that last year, and it was phenomenal. Just to be able to, you know, put it on there if you're going to follow your Canadian players, whatever the case may be, whoever you're loyal to, your hometown player, your buddy, you want to catch them, you know, you get the broadcast that you want. And then, you know, come Sunday, then, you know, you put it on the leaders or whatever the case may be. And you get the, like you said, the broadcast that you want. So the difficult part with the front and back, it'll be good. The play will be super concentrated, but it's going to be hard to, you know, keep up with players on both sides. And then also, you know, they've mentioned that Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player are going to be the honorary starters. Do they do it both off one, or is one go to one and the other goes to 10? Sorry, Gary, you take 10. I don't think they've clarified that yet. I'm sure they'll just be off of one when they do that honorary ceremony, but that could be funny.
Yeah, no, I think the move for the Masters, at least Thursday and Friday, you throw it on TV, and then you get the laptop out, and you get yeah. your featured group out, who you want to watch for the day. I think that'll be super entertaining. I can't wait. It's going to be awesome. I know I'll be locked into Corey Connors, you know, heading back. I know Kyle and him are really excited to get back there. So that'll be exciting. Yeah. And we're going to talk a lot about the Masters over the next couple of weeks. And I'm sure we'll have a lot of guests on that maybe be on the grounds that week, or, you know, get some inside knowledge. We'll have to catch up with maybe another caddy or something afterwards just to see what was going on at Augusta and the different fields. Other kind of big news items. Michelle Wee has entered in the U.S. Open after, you know, ooh. I said this when she retired. You know, I said it's not actually a retirement. Now, is she actually going to play the U.S. Open? We don't know, but she's practicing for something right now. What are your thoughts on Michelle Wee potentially teeing it up again?
Yeah, she's actually mentioned that, you know, this will actually be part of something where she's actually going to work back towards playing. So, you know.
You
so
heard it here all... first. By yeah. me, insider.
Yeah, exactly, as you said. So, you know, she's 50-50, and part of the reason she's 50-50 this year is she's not sure what the travel situation is going to be. And she also made an assumption as well that, you know, they're possibly the COVID situation would be a little bit better. You know, the event is being held in Houston down at Champions Club. So she has some trepidation that way. You know, her baby, Kenna, you know, was just born on June 19th. So, you know, planning to travel with a young baby family, there's a lot of factors there, as we've talked about in this podcast. So 50-50, but she is doing some prep and getting ready. Personally, I don't know. I don't think she will play. That's my gut instinct based on the interview she did with Beth Ann Nichols. You know, she sounded like she's 50-50, but there's still indications there that, you know, the health and the importance of her family is more important than anything, which it should be. Fresh from Russia, it looked like.
Yeah, that was interesting. This is going to make no sense for anybody, because I cut it out there, but we just had somebody try to get into our Zoom room in the middle of Scott's take. They decided not to turn on their camera. Interesting. That's the world we live in. People just showing up to random Zoom rooms. Sounds fun. But yeah, no, I'm looking forward to Michelle Wee potentially getting back. I think she's great for the game. Hopefully we see her in the future, and hopefully, you know, she at least is working towards something. And that's why I said yeah. back, she's going to miss it. That means her wrist is hopefully in a good place, which I think is important. And, you know, the U.S. Open's obviously important to her because that's the one that the major she's won. So, we're big Michelle Wie fans. I think she's a great broadcaster as well. I think it's tough too. You know, is how she's just had a baby. How much practice has she really been putting in, right? Like, does she want to make her return back and just go out there and embarrass herself?
Yeah, I don't think anybody really wants to be a ceremonial golfer, and she's someone who wants to be competitive, and she knows, although I don't think she really cares as much now as far as scrutiny or things like that. You know, she was more sensitive to that previously, but, you know, she's certainly come into her own, and, you know, she's a great follow. If people don't follow her on her social media, I mean, whether it's her art or food or whatever the case may be, she's proven to, you know, be somebody that's been through a lot and really made the most of it. And, you mentioned it, you know, big fan, you know, but, you know, had some interaction with her over the years, and she's always been great. So hopefully she gets back to it. And if it's not this year, then next year.
So what's the point of Callaway and Topgolf entering this merger? Is there any benefit? Is the experience changing in your eyes, or is it just money?
Well, I, you know, it's an all-stock transaction. Callaway's had an interest in Topgolf since 2006. They started investing in them back then. You know, they'd built their investment into up to about 14%. This merger agreement that they've entered into with Topgolf that was announced today will bring them up to 51.5%, so they'll have the controlling interest. Chip Brewer, who's the CEO of Callaway, will be the CEO in charge. I think it just allows them to expand what they've been doing as far as acquisitions. Callaway has been very active in acquisitions, whether that's Jack Wolfskin or other brands that are not just golf specific. This is a lifestyle play, and they understand that in order for you to get in touch with the whole market is not just the PGA Tour. It's the emerging golfer. It's the entertainment golfer. So they know that this is a real opportunity to influence golfers. And they can do it through the brand of another brand. And Topgolf is a growing brand. You know, they've done lots and lots of, you know, they've got lots and lots of locations. They're planning more locations. They're planning to expand more. I think it's just a way for them to have another tentacle in the golf industry and to have an active way to reach that average golfer and that emerging golfer and influence them and maybe influence them throughout their entire career.
That's fair. Yeah, I could see, you know, fittings going on there and all these sort of things that they could do and potentially sell products through there. So, you know, at least you own it. I would love if they figured out a way to get to Canada finally after years of talking, but I haven't seen it. Topgolf's fun. It is fun. It's expensive. Yeah. It's an expensive night when you go to Topgolf, especially when you're, you know, the waitress just keeps coming over with, "Hey, you want another drink?" Absolutely. Yep. I do. And then you forget they're about $12 US each, and then you walk out with $250 US bill in Phoenix, Arizona. I digress. But I think it'll be, I think hopefully it does something. They, you know, you added Callaway's budget now, and they have a presence in Canada. Maybe they do something in the Toronto area. Who knows? They've talked about it for years. It's difficult, obviously, you know, being that you're not going to be able to use it year round, but, you know, they have one in Pittsburgh. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, they had a working agreement with Cineplex Odeon, and unfortunately, Cineplex Odeon was bought as well. So that, you know, really put things to the side. And they were supposed to be the ones that were going to take care of that expansion into Canada, which, you know, it sat dormant for a while. Believe me, you know, another guest of ours, Rick Young, that was on here, and myself have been, you know, bugging their PR people nonstop for almost 3 years now. You keep going back for updates and updates and updates, and you really get the same runaround. And then as soon as we saw that the, you know, they had been bought out by another company who probably really doesn't have an interest in golf, then you're not sure that's really going to happen and whether it's the environment that's going to happen. But I would think at one point you'll see it happen. They look at their market penetration as being very little at this point, and they look at that having a big upside, and just going through their documents today. So there's certainly the potential for it, and you've got to think at some point they would come into this market. But you're right. They can control it now. Use it more as an outlet. You know, Callaway product was displayed there before. They had a certain presence that was involved there, but now they can be a lot more dominant and look at different ways to integrate that and be in the entertainment business, not just the golf business.
I love it. I think we got to get to our interview here, Scott, because, you know, throughout your take there, we had multiple people, again, trying to break into the Zoom room. And I don't know who these people are, what they want to do with T-Talk. You know, if you could just subscribe to the podcast, you could listen to all this for free. You don't have to actually look at our faces while you're doing it. But who do we have this week, Scott, for our interview? What do you think we're going to be chatting about?
Well, Neil Haworth is going to join us. Neil's a longtime architect from Canada originally, and spent a lot of time over in Asia developing golf courses, still doing a lot of work in Canada right now. But he's been involved with some very neat projects, golf courses that have hosted PGA Tour events, the longest golf course in the world, a golf course that was built at over 10,000 feet in China. And he's got some great ideas and concepts as well about, you know, the future of golf, where it's going, what he likes to see, and maybe some of the things we can expect to see in the next little while. All right, we want to welcome to the podcast architect Neil Haworth. Neil has done a lot of great work around the world, maybe not a name that a lot of people are familiar with, but very familiar with his golf courses. And, you know, he's got a lot of insight on the golf architecture. So, Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
First thing, as I mentioned, maybe a lot of people in North America, maybe not as familiar with your work because, you know, you've done a lot of work around the world, but why don't you give us a little backstory, you are Canadian, correct?
Correct. I grew up in Montreal, went to University of Guelph for, back in the early
80s. Fellow alumni, let's go.
Couple of Griffins here.
Yeah.
Was, claim to fame. Well, claim to fame was I, brought good luck to the Griffins, national, championship. When they won the football in 84, I drove the cheerleaders around because we beat McMaster in the first go. They were ranked number one in the world. I drove the Winnebago, and because of that, I continued to drive the cheerleaders, and we won the Vanier Cup. And I also won the, more importantly, though, I won the, and our team won the OUAA at the time, championship, golf championship at Westmount. So I had some great years at Guelph. Then I went to work for Graham Cook in Montreal for 4 years. I was fortunate to work on some really interesting projects during that time. It was a good booming economy. And then a friend of mine who I went to Guelph with was working in Singapore and ended up going overseas for a Hawaiian company that was doing some work, golf course designs and landscape and in Asia. So I ended up in Singapore kind of overnight within a couple of months.
Let's back you up just a little bit there because I think you skipped a couple of things, but
okay.
How did you get into, you know, wanting to go to Guelph for landscape architecture? I mean, you know, you obviously had to have some sort of interest in playing the game, and then how did you become, you know, knowledgeable in the fact that there was this profession and it was something that you wanted to pursue?
Yeah, it's a question that I get asked by a lot of people who, you know, kind of wanted to be golf course architects or, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I used to have model railways. I had aquariums and my grandfather got me into the game of golf. But for me, the model railways, I was always more interested in the creative side, doing the landscape, the aquariums. I didn't, you know, the fish were, you know, I hate to say this, but if they died, I'd just get new fish. But I was always changing the landscape in the aquarium. And to be honest with you, Glenn Abbey, Jack Nicklaus, I didn't really know there was a profession in golf course architecture. But once Nicklaus came in and did Glenn Abbey and then got the publicity throughout Canada, and it was probably, what, 14 or 15 at the time, I realized that there was a profession in golf course architecture. And so that kind of, I tailored my studies towards landscape golf course architecture. Did a little bit of civil engineering in McGill, and before I got accepted into Guelph, because we had to do a year ahead of time. So, and then got into Guelph, and yeah, it was great. I mean, the program at Guelph, both turf grass. I took the turf grass courses. Went to England on a study abroad. Studied the golf course of Scotland, England. So it was something that a passion that I had and something I focused to do.
So when you headed over to the Asian market, obviously it was at a time when things were booming over there with golf course development. Can you maybe explain a little bit to, you know, our listeners kind of what the environment was at that time and, you know, kind of what it is versus maybe what North America is like as far as golf course developments?
Yeah, back when I went in the early 90s, it was just getting going. And Thailand was the first real market that got going. And I went over actually to work for this Hawaiian company, Bell Collins, to look after a couple of courses in Thailand. And there was no expertise. There was nobody knew what golf was, really. So there was a lot of expats, experience from other countries that were coming in to provide the knowledge and to develop some high quality golf courses because the money was there. But over time, the knowledge of golf, the markets, they've matured tremendously to where today I'm going to say it's different, but the markets are probably they're more expensive, obviously, to play golf. But yeah, it's come a long way since in 30 years for sure.
How much would a round of golf be at a nice golf course over there if you could convert it into Canadian dollars?
Yeah, so if I could compare something like a course like you'd play around Ottawa, say Emerald Links, I'm going to say because it's right, I live here in Manitic, nearby, that's what, $50 for 18 holes. Probably the equivalent quality around the city centers in Asia, excluding Hong Kong and Singapore, because they're but outside of that, they're probably $150 to $200 for the same experience.
That's crazy.
In Singapore, Hong Kong, you couldn't get on them. But yeah, typically the big centers like Ottawa or Montreal and the equivalent in Asia, yeah, probably three or four or five times more.
Does that change anything for you from a design aspect, knowing the value of, how much somebody's paying versus like over here, like maybe you're not getting away with not looking at every small detail in Asia?
In Asia, you can, you spend your time trying to educate people. Whereas here, people know what sand they need to buy for the greens. Now there might be two or three distributors that they can negotiate with, but in Asia, you need to, first of all, educate them that they need river sand versus beach sand. You need to explain and convince them to spend the money because it's not the key and import irrigation from the US or wherever. So there's a lot of, you spend your time educating people rather than focusing on the details. I always say, here it's kind of easy. You go into a meeting and everybody speaks English or French, which I do. But over there, everybody's speaking Chinese or Vietnamese or Bahasa. So it's difficult to focus on the details. Yes, that is so true.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of challenges in working in foreign markets, and you've worked in a lot of those foreign markets. Was there a particular market or a country that was more challenging than others, or more interesting than others for you?
I don't know about more interesting. Challenging, China was at first, because when we first, I think at some point 10 years ago or 15 years ago, we designed 20% or 25% of all the golf courses in China. But at the beginning, our clients were from Hong Kong or Singapore, and they had very Western values as far as dealing with consultants. Then the local Chinese became the developers, and we had a hard time convincing them to spend the money in the right place. We had a hard time getting paid. And there was a big learning curve on how to, at the end of the day, have a quality product. For instance, in Canada, clients will pay you for what you've done. In China, they'll pay you because they need something. They'll pay you for what you've done because they need something more from you. So it's a different philosophy. So we got it was tough at the beginning, but by the end of, after 5 or 6 years, and we know how to deal with the Chinese, we were fairly successful, both, especially getting the quality golf courses built.
Now, were you shocked, or I mean, you probably weren't, but in the end, some of these golf courses that you worked on ended up becoming venues for, you know, major professional tournaments, PGA Tour events, for an example. People may be not familiar that courses like TPC Kuala Lumpur, other ones that have hosted the HSBC World Golf Championships. Is that just a feather in your cap, or is that something that you knew was going to happen when those designs were being built?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, KLG's TPC Kuala Lumpur, we did the original design. It was actually the first project that I was fully involved with over there. So it was a great learning experience. It's been remodeled by another group since then, and but they've come a long way. Shushan International, which is in Shanghai and that hosts the HSBC Champions, the WGC event every year. Actually, I'm supposed to be there this week. It's kind of I'm getting all these Facebook reminders 1 year ago, and I'm like standing over Rory McIlroy or walking the fairways with Tiger. But
oh, you're spending your time with us. That's pretty
much there you go, isn't it? I'll call you Rory and Tiger. We got sure. It. But yeah, I mean, it's one of the few projects. Like, oh, these clients have huge egos. They have lots of money, and they say, oh, we want to do this. We want to do this. This client, he was very low key. He listened. He traveled. He was very educated. He was a restaurant owner to start with, some of the best seafood restaurants in Shanghai. But he wanted to learn, and we never talked about professionals playing this golf course. We never talked about tournaments. 1 year after opening, I'm walking down the first fairway with Tiger Woods and listening to him talk to his entourage saying, hey, this is awesome. You know, but we never, it's one of the few projects, high profile projects that going in, we never thought about, and look what's happened since then. I mean, it's been a huge feather in our cap, but yeah, it's really cool.
I got to know, you know, I've always wondered this. You hear it all the time, you know, amateurs, people on TV, regardless, you know, that's a great golf hole or that's a bad golf hole. In your eyes, what is the difference? What makes a good golf hole and what makes a bad golf hole?
Well, I think a golf hole has to be fair. It has to be exciting. It has to be memorable. You want to go back and play it. Obviously, if you're on the, you know, we've done a couple of projects in Hawaii, right on the coast, Mauna Lani, and, you know, the great golf hole. You got the Pacific Ocean, the waves crashing on your, you know, on your doorstep. But I think it's the playability and the excitement, and people, you know, are challenged, and it makes you think. And the average golfer, they look at it differently, but I think that's what's key for a golf course architect, is to understand how the average golfer appreciates a hole and not look at it just from, you know, the 5% of us that are aficionados. I think because we're not the people playing it every day. And I think that's something that's really important, is that golfers, we understand what golfers actually appreciate in a golf hole. But at the end of the day, they want to be challenged. They want to have fun. And I think one of my if you hit a good shot and it's going like you think it's going to go in the lake, it's not going to go in the lake. I kind of like, if you're like 3 yards off the lake, I kind of like the fact that if it kicks back into the fairway, like when you're building a golf course, you kick back rather than kicking into the lake. Because I think when people get off the course, it's, oh, you know what? I almost went in the lake there, but I had a shot into the green and I made a par or a birdie, or I had an opportunity, or going under trees or whatever. But I think it's getting golfers excited, and through the shaping and the contouring, you get them rewarded for living on the edge type of thing. And I think they probably won't notice that, but I do notice those type of things.
It's kind of neat to actually hear that as far as that insight, because you're right. A lot of people probably don't think about that. On that same vein, though, I mean, obviously with the, you know, the proliferation of the internet, there's a lot of people out there that talk about golf course architecture and things. They probably played a lot of golf courses, but, you know, they start to become what they think are, you know, design critics or experts, but they're not really designers. Do you have any thoughts on some of those people, or you just sort of, you know, kind of, you know, just don't really pay attention to them, and you know, you just maybe dismiss the fact of, oh, you played a lot of golf courses, but you're not an architect, so you probably don't really know exactly what we are trying to do when we build that design.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and I learned this as a, early on in my career as well. It's easy to design a difficult golf course. And when you hear members or golfers talk about golf courses, they always want to make it difficult and challenge in the wrong way, because they make it might be challenging for their handicap. But, you know, you put a lake in front of the green on a 300-yard par four, or a 200-yard par three. I mean, for the pros and the better players, it's easy to carry it. But for the higher handicappers, it's not. So a lot of people just think about difficulty. But dealing with that question, I mean, that is what committee members are all about. So I have to listen to them. I have to strategically modify my answers on this question, because they're excited. They want to do it, and rightfully so. And it's going through the process. And I think if you go through the process and understanding any type of decision design-wise that you make, there's got to be reasons for it. You can't just say, I like this, or this would be great, but why? And usually there's a minimum of three reasons you do something, maybe five reasons you do something, whether it's drainage, whether it's playability, whether it's the high handicap or the low handicap. But any feature or design changes or modifications to a golf hole, I think my role is to, especially when it comes to committees and renovation, is to take everybody's input and get them to understand what they're thinking, how they're thinking, the implications of it. Yes, what they say might be right, but there's implications to other levels of golf courses or maintenance or whatever. So it's part of the process. And it's kind of the fun part of the deal is, just listening to people. And I'm fortunate to do this for a profession, but these guys are, usually, when you come to committee members of private clubs, they're very successful in business and they hire consultants. But when they get out on the golf course and on a committee, they kind of feel like they're free and it's their relaxing time. Whereas I'm at work, so I kind of it's a fun part of the job, to be honest with you. But you have to have patience and you have to have understanding. But
yeah, I meant a little less of maybe the committees or stuff like that. But you just see a lot of people that count themselves as being an architecture expert. You see a lot of them on Twitter and social media and stuff like that. When as I mentioned, maybe they've just played a lot of golf courses, so they're self appointed more than anything. But I always wonder how much that bothers architects.
Well, when they're a pro with a name on it and they think they're like that, then yes.
There you go. Fair enough.
Because they have played a lot of good golf courses. That's true.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, if they've only played a lot of golf courses and then maybe played that golf course one time, they obviously don't know it as intimately as you would or an architect would in looking at it from a design principle standpoint. So, you're obviously going to see something a little different than a consumer might. And, they end up might being somebody who, makes a seven on the hole, and next thing you know, they think it's a terrible hole when really it probably isn't.
Correct. And I've seen that a lot with my friends as well, playing golf with them in foursomes as well. I've seen that so many times. Yep.
Do you, from a designer standpoint, are there any golf courses out there, famous golf holes, where everyone thinks it's a great golf hole, but you actually, view it differently, that it's not actually a good golf hole? And what would be the reason why, if there is one?
A golf hole? Wow.
Or a course, if you'd rather go down that road too. I'm fine with either.
Yeah, without getting into architects' names or anything.
Oh, of course.
I think there's a few, you can probably figure out the name of the architect, but there's a few U.S. Open courses that end up being quite similar because they just lengthened them and they made them difficult rather than adding strategy. So I think there's a few courses out there that have kind of lost their way in that sense. I like playing quirky golf courses, or I like playing great golf courses. The golf courses in between, and that's where a lot of people find like great golf holes. But I don't see. I don't know. That's a tough question. Can we edit that one? That was a tough question.
No, it's all good. I think.
Let me think about it. But maybe you can ask it again before the end of the.
It's fair. I think it's hard to, to call out fellow designers for things and knowing how difficult the job is. So let's go down the road of how difficult it is in 2020 to design a golf course, especially a championship golf course. In your eyes, what do you think is the best way to actually design one to fight against, and I put fight against in quotations, this whole, you know, pump and gouge the golf course and not worry about where it goes and just hit it as far as possible. You know, what's your best way in your eyes to actually design it against that and actually make it so you do have to shape shots a little better?
Yeah. From a design point of view, lengthening it does nothing because they're just going to get longer and longer. The more you lengthen it, really realize that like DeChambeau right now, I mean, what recently they were showing he carried it 403 yards or something. In his preparation for Augusta, I mean, you can't really keep lengthening it. And you can narrow fairways, you can grow the rough. At the end of the day, I mean, it's for these tournament courses, and obviously I work with the European Tour every year and the PGA Tour every year at Shushan, and the Volvo China opens at our course in Shenzhen. You're really dependent on the weather. And if it rains the week before or entering the weekend and it rains, boy, oh boy, it doesn't matter where you put the pins. They're going to be shooting darts. And but I did an interview recently with CNN and with golf. And what are your thoughts? And I remember 20 years ago, we were doing a project with Nick Price, and he was saying, well, just eliminate the 60 degree wedges and above. This was 20 years ago. I mean, even now, I mean, but these guys have 65 degree wedges. And so if you're like 50 yards from the green, make them hit a pitching wedge or a sand wedge or a 54 degree or something. Don't give them the 60, 65s, probably go up to 68 degrees. You never know, you never know what DeChambeau is going to do, but take away the tools. I mean, if you take away the tools from a good mechanic in a shop, then he's not going to be able to do the job properly. So take away that advantage of hitting it 400 yards. And the tour is not going to, when they set up the courses, they're going to keep the standard width at 23, 25. They're not going to say, okay, the pro Mike Weary hits it 270. So we're going to make the fairway 30 yards wide there, but DeChambeau hits it 350. So we're going to make the fairway 15 yards there. They're not going to do that. They're going to keep it consistent for all the golfers. So that's, widening and narrowing the fairway is not going to be an option for those guys. But, you talk about the ball size and scaling back the ball. But, it's design-wise, there's not a lot we can really do. It's all about up to the weather and the authorities, to be honest with you.
And I mean, when you talk about, you mentioned going over to the UK, and we had a little bit of discussion about this, is that where the sort of the brilliance of some of those designs, like the West Links at North Barracks, where it's a little quirkier, and but it puts a different test to the player beyond just length, and there's a lot more shot value and different interesting things. Again, you're never going to defend it if all of a sudden that golf course is soggy, but rarely is it. So are those type of design elements that you saw over there something that attract you?
Yeah, definitely. And quirkiness is a really difficult thing to design. And but one of the things, I'm going to go to like Coeur Crenshaw and Gil Hans and Cabot Links, Cabot Cliffs, the great sites, some sandy sites, Tasmania, Bendigo. There's some great sites and they're sandy, and you can do quirkiness because it's all sandy. But if you get a mountainous site in rock, a flat site in clay, it's tough to design in quirkiness. Quirkiness is kind of Mother Nature's gift to their input to the golf course, those types of things. And you look at Royal Ottawa, I mean, the quirkiness of the fairways, I mean, the little humps and bumps, and we've done three new holes plus we're doing a short game area. It's really tough to get on a D4, D5 bulldozer and shape in quirkiness. It's and then have it drain and not have the ice damage in the springs. And so from that point of view, and quirkiness, also green speeds have come up so fast, and you can't get quirky greens anymore. I mean, to design greens like Augusta or Oak Mount or, you know, look at Coeur Crenshaw, what they tried to do at Shinnecock a couple of years for the U.S. Open. And they're on the edge. And for the average play, you know, designing to the on the limit is really, really tough. So I think going back to that, you know, your original question, I think it's designing that into a modern day golf course is very difficult. And I think it's more Mother Nature, just appreciating the site values and incorporating it rather than designing it.
That's interesting. I actually haven't heard anyone talk about the fast greens and the design of like how that actually hurts the design of a golf course. I'd love to hear more thoughts on green speed and what do you feel is the actual ideal conditions of the green speed. Is that based on Mother Nature as well?
Well, I think the green speeds is all about playability, and not just from difficulty, but pace of play. I mean, if your speeds are so fast and you're three putting all the time, it's going to take longer to play the golf course. If the greens are contoured and with lots of rolls, and you get the green speeds up, people are going to be three, four putting, and it's going to take longer to play. So I think that's very detrimental to the game of golf. And but you know, weather dictates green speeds. You're easy to get up the green speeds in the fall and the spring here in Ottawa area, Ottawa Valley area. I think green speeds should not be a focus. They should be managed properly and not focused by the committee members, focusing on the speed of the greens. The watering of the golf course and having everything green, Augusta National style. I think we need to get away from that as well.
Oh, but I agree 100%. We've talked about that on here. And now I want to take that down that different direction.
Yeah, that's another one.
I'm all for hard golf courses, like, and I mean physically hard, brown. You know, I'm all for that. Do you, when you're going into a design, is it knowing that the golf course will be that way you can design it? Or is it you're just designing the best golf course, and if they make the conditions that way, that's one thing versus, you know, actually designing it for those type of conditions?
Okay, so in Asia, most of the golf courses we did were sand capped. So there was, rather than stripping topsoil and putting topsoil back like you would do here in Ottawa or Quebec, Ontario, they would import sand and build the fairway similar to how we would build tees here. So there was more, assuming you kind of figure out at the beginning the budget and the client's direction. So if you felt that the client was going to do a good job with drainage and sand capping, then you could understand that the ball was, you would be able to play the golf course firm and fast. So you would design accordingly. If the budget and the client's philosophy was to save money and not to do the important things like that, then you would design it a little bit differently from the playability point of view. But here in Ottawa, I remember going out to Royal Ottawa a couple of weeks ago in Commonly, and I played a couple of other courses in the Montreal area that are basically on clay and topsoil, and Royal Ottawa's on sand, and how firm walking just underfoot, forget it. You could just feel the firmness of the ground. And it was really, really, it felt really, really good. Really good. So yeah. So firmness is, but you need sand to get firmness.
So before we get to some trends and some things that, you know, maybe we want to talk about a little bit of what's happening in architecture, I want to go back a little bit and mention one golf course, because I thought it was really unique. And I'm kind of wondering the story behind it. I'm sure you've told the story a million times, but you happen to be the guy who designed the longest golf course in the world, but it's also at over 10,000 feet. So it didn't necessarily play that length, but, you know, over 8,000 yards long in the Jade Snow Dragon. Can you tell us a little bit the story behind that golf course? Because I've been fascinated with knowing that you were involved with that project.
Yeah. So that project came up through a contractor client that we had. We'd worked on a Shenzhen golf club before with them, Forward Golf. They ended up doing, I forget what the name is, on Hainan with Coeur Crenshaw as well after that. But we got involved. It was up at 10,000, 3,000 meters, 10,000 feet. And beautiful sight, beautiful views. But yeah, we were a little confused. And but we ended up bringing up Zheng Lianwei, who was at the time the number one golfer in China. So this would have been 2002 time. So he just won, he just beat Ernie Els in the Singapore Open, a European Tour golf event. He was easily the top top golfer in China. So we ended up doing a little bit of a co-design with him. And he went up there, and we started hitting balls off the dirt. And, you know, we figured out he was hitting his nine irons to 3 irons, about 20% further. His driver probably 30% further.
Wow.
So
I might hit 250 then.
Yeah, but don't forget, that's a pro. If you top the ball along the ground, that thin air ain't going to help you at all. So the forward tees, yeah, no, the forward tees are exactly the same as any other golf course. It's just kind of the blue and the black, or whatever they have right there. But the blue and the black tees were pushed back. Probably the blues 10% and the golds or blacks or whatever 20%. But the other thing was it was really interesting. The thin air, the ball spins like the ball when it's spinning doesn't grab the air as much, so you don't get as much backspin. So you're not going to be sucking the ball back as much. So it'll just land and it'll be like as a dud. And if you slice the ball, it won't grab the air, so it won't go off to the side as much. Your slice will be less pronounced. So it was a really, really interesting experience designing. Yeah, it was really cool. And
Did I read they have oxygen on the carts and stuff?
Yep, they have bags of oxygen on the back of the carts. Yep, yeah.
Is it because you're just that high in the air? You need it?
I never did. I mean, I would go up there all the time.
Some of us aren't athletes, so.
Yeah, well, yeah. But yeah, no, I've never, I know people do. I know, but the thing is, if you come from ground level, sea level, from Singapore, let's say, and you fly directly there, 3-hour flight, and you get off the plane, and then you go directly on the golf course, your body hasn't adapted. Whereas I would probably arrive in the evening, my body would adapt before I. But if you arrive from sea level and go strenuously onto the golf course and do some walk, yeah, some people's if you have asthma or something, or I don't know, I've seen people use them, but I've never used it myself.
Crazy. So I mean, that must be a neat thing though to, you know, actually have a golf course that's in the Guinness Book of World Records for, yeah, you know, some, yeah, element that's certainly different. And what's the total length? 8,400 and some odd yards?
Well, it's got an 8 in it at the end because it's good Chinese. 8,468.
Okay. That's,
and I remember just after I got the Guinness Book of World Record, I remember having a beer with Brian Curley from Schmidt Curley, and he was, yep, doing a golf course with John Daly. And they wanted to have they wanted to beat us. I said, Brian, what are you going to do? If you beat us by 10 yards, we're going to add a back tee. So don't even think about it. You know, we don't want to start competing there. So I'm not sure if that course ever got built.
So what was your best? I assume you played it from the back tees at least once.
Yeah, I've played it a few times. Yeah.
Okay. What was your best score from the back tee?
Oh, I don't know. Well, yeah, I would have played the back tee. I'm not sure. I probably picked up on a couple. I can't play the golf from the back tee. I mean, I remember running out of balls on one hole one course I designed. I just had no balls, but playing from the back tee. So yeah.
And just to be clear, there are no snow dragons actually up there, right?
No. J Dragon Snow Mountain. Yeah. So it's, yeah, J Dragon Snow Mountain. Yeah.
All right. Just checking. All right. Last one here. Just want to get to kind of some of the trends that we're seeing happening in the industry. You know, we talked about a little bit some of the short courses, things like the Cradle at Pinehurst, other practice areas. As you mentioned, you're working on one right now at Royal Ottawa. What are your thoughts on that sort of trend that, you know, it's being embraced by, you know, golf courses, golf clubs, and resorts to make these facilities that are, you know, a little different than just making another 7,400 yard golf course?
I think it's great. I went to the Masters back in 90, first time to the Masters in 96. And I remember going out to the par 3 tournament, watching, it was Tiger was amateur there, and but watching Nicholas player, Tiger, families going out there, kids caddying, and then when Augusta and the TV networks decided to pick up the par three tournament. I think that was a huge deal for golf. And now you're looking at what Gil Hans Pinehurst did, and now Tiger's doing the par three at Pebble Beach. The PXG guy, the little bad nine in Arizona. These par three courses, I think you look at families going out, and you look at going out for a couple hours and just having fun, and like the Thistle do at Pinehurst as well. Just a big putting course, originally the Himalaya or the ladies putting course there in at St. Andrews. I mean, I think this is great for the future of golf, and I'm so excited when I see this type of development for golf. And I remember Pete Dye saying about par threes, I mean, you can do whatever you want with par threes, because assuming the golfer plays from the right tee, you can do whatever you want. It's not like on a par four or par five when you hit your drive in the woods or somewhere down the fairway and then you have to be fair for everybody. Par threes, you know, as long as people hit from the right tees, you from a creative point of view, you're, you know, the template, you got anything you can do. You know, everything's open for you. So I think from a creative point of view, and from for golf and for everything, I think par three courses, maintenance, environment, sustainability, I think par three courses are, I want to see more and more of them. And I'm hoping that to get the opportunity to design a few. I mean, they always had a bad kind of, not reputation, but it was always like, at a campground or national, you know, just basic, like basic little, an activity to do. But I think it can really become a strong focal point and a really important part of golf as we move forward.
Perfect. Well, thanks, Neil. Really appreciate your insight. Amazing to find out, especially about, you know, a lot of things that happen in the Asian market, and which is something a lot of people don't think about. Also great to know sort of your thoughts from behind the scenes, because we always see the golf courses from the front. It's always nice to know what actually goes on in how they're developed and so forth. So thanks for coming onto the podcast. Really, really appreciate it. And looking forward to playing some of your projects in the future.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Neil, for that interview. Really appreciate it. My favorite question that I asked was, what makes a good golf hole? You always hear that old saying, right? It's like, this is a good golf hole, or that's a horrible golf hole. And nice to actually hear the take from an actual, you know, designer of golf courses that looks at a piece of land and how to create a good golf hole, what an actual good golf hole means in their eyes. So I enjoyed that interview. It's nice to get people from all different types of segments in the world of golf.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we all think we're experts when we go out there and play. It's nice to actually hear from an expert themselves and give us a real reality check of what really goes on in designing golf courses.
And it's difficult to do. So, well, I think we're going to hit up birdie or bogey again this week. You know, a couple weeks in a row now we've brought it back. So we had a few birdie or bogeys going on here. I'm going to ask them, and we're going to give our take. Do we like it with a birdie, or do we dislike it with a bogey? Are you ready for birdie or bogey, Scotty?
All right, let's do it.
All right, birdie or bogey, hitting golf balls into a net in the winter. I'm going to assume you can't see it. There's no track man, nothing. You're just hitting it into a net. That's all you got. Are you giving that a birdie or bogey?
I would give it a bogey. I mean, back in the 80s and the 90s, it probably was your only option. But I think now there's a lot better options. And I think the difficulty with just hitting into a net is that you're right. You don't have any feedback. So it becomes just exercise and making swings. Worst case scenario, sure. But in most cases, you prefer something at least gives you some sort of feedback, distance, contact, whatever the case may be, video, you name it. So I'll give it a bogey.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you're hitting golf balls for results. Yes, practice is important, and the right practice will lead the right result. But if you don't know where it's going right off the bat, or, you know, after 3 months of working on the same thing, you could be working on something that you're so stuck in the feel of that eventually you just can't get out of it, and you have no idea where the ball is going. So it's absolutely a bogey for me. If you can find a place to go hit golf balls, definitely do it, where you actually can see and get on TrackMan or a quad or wherever. But just hitting them for the sake of hitting them into a net, it's better than nothing. I will give you that.
Yeah.
Birdie or bogey, always playing ready golf.
That's a no brainer for me. That's an eagle. You know, I've always been a big advocate of that. I'm always shocked when I'm playing in a group and somebody's, you know, just waiting there. And you're just like, just go ahead. Like, you made a birdie, and then and they're like hesitating. And I'm like, just, you're closest to the tee, just tee it up and go. I mean, you know, they all get caught up in honors. For some reason, there's this, you know, perception that it's a rule. That's great if it's a match. But in most cases, as far as a casual game and whatever the case may be, it's just, you know, it's just honors. Honors is not mandatory. So, just go and play like as quickly as possible. You're ready to go. And even that's the case of being down in the fairway too, not just off the tees. You know, people look over, ooh, are you 192 and a half? No, I'm 193. And how much time do you waste just doing it? I get it. You're trying to be as polite as possible. But if you establish that, in advance and just say, you know what, when you're over top of the ball, near your ball, you're ready to go, just go ahead and hit. You'll have a great day. It's enjoyable. Everybody will be happy, and you'll just move along quickly.
Yeah, no, I'm 100% on that. Birdie for me, you know, whoever's there, go hit. I actually had a hole in one last year. In the next hole, my buddy hit first. I don't care. Like, I really do not care. And I also, the opposite, I don't care if you care that you had a birdie, so you should go first, because I'm just going to hit. I do not care if you care about it. It does not matter.
If I look up and I see the player like hesitating, they're digging around in their bag or whatever.
I'm done. I'm smacking it.
T's going in the ground, boom, I'm hitting. I'll apologize afterwards.
No, I won't even apologize. You hurry up if that's the case. If you're not ready when it's supposed to be your turn in quotation marks, that's on you, not on me. So absolutely. Number three, talk about the Masters a lot. The Masters online shop is only available to ticket holders of the Masters and the Augusta National Women's what's that?
Amateur.
Amateur. That's A there.
You'll be okay.
Yeah, I would love to go to that event. Is that a birdie or bogey for you?
I think it's a bogey for me. I mean, I think there's an opportunity there. I get it. They're trying to control this as much as possible, but you know, we're in a special situation this year where, you know, obviously patrons, spectators can't be there. I think this is maybe an opportunity, especially with how much merchandise they can possibly sell. There's an opportunity there for even a charitable situation where they can say, you know what?
Yeah, because that's what they're known for.
Well, you'd be surprised as far as all the things that there's a lot of stuff that's not announced and things like that. But you're right. This is something where they could actually do something from a PR standpoint. And I think really too, again, it's an exceptional situation, you know, with the fact, probably, well, hopefully in the future that there are able to be patrons and spectators that are there. This is a, you know, the rare opportunity. So why not open it up for a year, make a lot of people really, really happy. And really that's what it's about more than anything.
I'm actually giving it a birdie. I think the feeling of going to Augusta National, and it kind of goes against, you could probably go back and hit everything else I've said in the past, is the exclusiveness of it and the fact that you fought so hard to get that ticket and you've been in that lottery for so many years that when you get a piece of apparel from there, generally speaking, you know, so you got it. You were there. You bought it from there, right? And people are like, oh, you went. Awesome. That's really cool, right? I know you've gone. I've never been there, so I don't know what it's like. And it's something I'm jealous. So I'll give it a birdie. I think, you know, for people that go, they want to have that feeling. That being said, I have sent a text to a few people I know are going to be there, potentially see if I can get a hat. I kind of want, though, an Augusta National hat, not a Masters hat. I just want an Augusta National hat. So we're going to see if we can get one of those in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think the only other issue with that is that there are, you know, it was exclusive for many, many years. But if you actually Google it right now, you can actually find that there are secondary market.
I'll buy the fake stuff. I don't care.
No, but there's ones that are
I know, but I'll buy the fake stuff too.
Yeah, but they have buyers in there, you know, trying to lap up as much as possible and sell it afterwards or whatever. So exactly. It's not as exclusive as most people think.
No, but I do understand that's like they talk about Augusta National at the Masters, like, oh, all the food prices haven't changed. The apparel prices have most definitely changed. They probably keep up with, you know, things like the Phoenix Open where a t-shirt's $40 US and a hat's 50, shit like that. Wow, I dropped an S-bomb. I'm going to have to make this one explicit, just like a few episodes ago. I'm not editing those out anymore. We're either good to go or not. All right, we got two more. This one, birdie or bogey, direct-to-consumer golf companies. We're talking stuff like Haywood Golf. We're talking stuff like...
Ben Hogan, I guess.
Ben Hogan now. Yeah. There's a couple others out there that are, you know, I guess PXG, you could say, can do that as well. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I still think access is really important, and I don't think you're going to, you know, you're not going to shut down that chain. It really happens. You know, it would be nice if, you know, this is not about supporting the retailers and supporting the pros. I mean, obviously you can, and you should do that, especially if you're you know, a member at a club or whatever the case may be, but certain brands are going to do certain things. It's just the way it is. My only concern always is fitting. If people are investing a lot of money in equipment, trying to get a fit by just doing something online, it's hard to get something really exact. And so that's my only warning. You might save some money that way, which is, again, you're right. And it's a right of these companies to provide this avenue that's out there. But that would just be the concerns. But overall, I would say it's a birdie. I say it's just a part of the changing market, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. And as you said, manufacturers, PXG, Callaway, TaylorMade, you just look in the manufacturers' websites, you can actually find direct sales. They may not be cheaper prices in those cases than what you're going to find at retail. But, you know, if you're in the middle of Nebraska and you don't have a pro shop that's even close to you, you know what? Those are golfers too. So they need to get access to equipment. So I'll just give it a birdie.
Absolutely. It's a birdie for me. Independence as a business owner is important to me, and being able to start, you know, have entrepreneurs out there and be able not to be held to prices due to a pro shop or prices due to whatever, and losing costs, you know, like losing revenue, being able to do it direct, you know, it's going to open up. And there's some great companies out there. Like, I think some of my favorite irons ever, Scratch, right? Yeah. Like, Scratch at one point were direct to consumer well before their time. And then you could have found them in their golf towns and all that stuff. And then they disappeared. And those irons were great. And I'm drawing a blank on the one. It's something to do with the level number 4 or 6 or something like that. It's a new company out there right now. They're making great irons. Maybe you can help me, or, you know, help throw me a bone here at all.
No, I'm actually watching you swim around. So it's actually kind of funny.
Haywood, for example, we've had, you know, we had him on here, and their wedges are spectacular. He sent us one each, and I went out and bought a couple more and directly from them, shipped to the door. And, you know, those are the type of businesses I want to support. So I'm all
for it. You're talking about New Level Golf, by the way.
I am talking about New Level Golf. That is what I was trying to get at. But I swear there's like a 40, I don't know, maybe somewhere.
Yeah, it's another company. There's multiple companies that are out there.
And they're all using great manufacturers. They all do their due diligence. It's not like those golf balls out there, like the, you know, Crush golf balls or the Vice golf balls, where it's all the exact same golf ball, right? Like, these are actual clubs they're designing. Yes, they might have the same materials as the other ones, but, you know, they're designing them and they're doing their research and they're putting their time into it. So I'm all for it. All right, one more, and then we'll hit the mailbag this week, Scotty. Final birdie versus bogey. Golf course is closing while there's still potential for some golf weather. Where's this? Because it's not here.
I guess it's, you know, in a variety of areas. You know what, for me, having been on that side of the industry, it's great when a golf course can stay open as late as possible for people to enjoy it. But you know, when you look at a place like a member club, for an example, there's not really any more revenue coming in that situation.
It is
you
a
know,
loss. You, as
right. Yeah. It is a loss. So if they work that in, that's fine. In the other side of it as well, when you talk about the superintendents and stuff, they got to get these golf courses to bed. So if you want it in good shape come spring, there's a lot of things that they have to do to prepare the golf course. And they can't necessarily do that with golfers trumping all over the place and, you know, in the middle of snowstorms and things like that. So I'm good with golf courses that have to close at a particular time. So this one, I guess, is a birdie for me. I guess that's the way to think about it. The fact is, you know what? They get to a point where they have to close. They have to close.
It's a bogey for me. If your course has the ability to play golf, then let's play golf, baby. If you don't want to run a pro shop, if say you're a private club, you don't want to run a pro shop, you don't want to, you know, work on the golf course, really. Maybe all you're really doing is cutting the greens, just kind of keeping things very basic on maintenance mode. Well, then do that. But your golf course, you know the business you're in, just shutting down, even though people paid membership fees, unless it's literally built in that here's the starting date we start. And if we are late, then we will push it late. If it's not built in, then, you know, that's on you. I'm leaving it open. Let's play golf, baby. I would play this weekend, I think, if the weather was okay. But the golf courses are soaked right now, too.
Yeah, they are
and
pretty
wet. That makes it pretty difficult. And throw a nice layer of snow on top of it, and who knows what they're looking like. So I think I've hit my last golf ball, though, for the year, at least in Canada. Who knows? Maybe we get some crazy weather and 20 degrees of sun and in November. Who knows? It's not going to happen, but who knows? Can't we get something positive out of 2020, right?
Hey, like, you know what? It's happened
before.
It's
been the weirdest year already. So, yeah. What is the latest round you've played? I think we've talked about this before. I remember mine. December 22nd was mine. Golf course said, hey, we're closed. If there's pins out there, though, throw what you can in this and through the door, basically. And we went out and played nine holes, and it was freezing cold and had the mittens on and the toques on. But hey, it was at least I have that date now.
Yeah, I'm not going to count British Columbia because obviously
no, that doesn't count
there most of the season. But here in Ontario, where we are, I've played Christmas Day. I've played January 6th. I've played, and some of them were in rain. So it depends whether it's weird or not, where all of a sudden you get this weird weather and it's fine. It just was a neat opportunity one time when it was a Christmas Day. And I thought, you know, what are the chances that I'll ever get to golf again on Christmas Day? And I was right, because I have never had that chance again to go and do that. Unfortunately, the golf course where I'm at now, once they close, and I don't need military police chasing me off the golf course. So it's not going to happen again.
Fair enough. I will. Maybe we'll get that out there. But yeah. All right. Well, why don't we hit the mailbag this week, Scotty? Full mailbag, as per usual. Hit it up. What do we got?
Yeah, filled up quickly this week. Appreciated everybody getting those into us. All right, let's get started here right away. What is the optimal number of par fives on a golf course?
My perfect design golf course is 666. Yeah. I've talked about this many times. It's the most fun when you get 6 par 5, 6 par 3, 6 par 4s. I know people don't like that. Some people, it's not traditional. Nothing's, who cares? It's fun. I think it gives you the biggest mix. So if you're asking me, it has to be in that. It has to be that, though. If it was like 6 par 5s and then like 8 par 3 and then we're getting a little crazy, but who cares? I said, as who cares at the end of the day, it's just golf. So I like the 666. What about you?
Yeah, I'm in with that as well. I played the Marshes up in Ottawa last Friday, and it's a 6, 6, and 6. You know, people have to understand, though, that I like it because of, you know, for length off the tee, opportunities to get onto par fives and two. That one, not so much, because a couple of the par fives are 600 plus
one,
yards.
Is that two?
Number two.
Yeah. Two that just like, it's like a banana that just kept going and just going and water all down the right, but everything doglegs right. It's an interesting hole.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And, you know, I think the difficult part, though, the balance is the 6 par 3s. It actually toughens it up because, you know, generally for me, I end up with 6 much longer approaches than I normally would have into a lot of holes. So people
balances
can't. Right. So people can't automatically think of it as being an easier golf course, but I'm with you. I like that balance. I'm not a fan of going to a place where all of a sudden it's, you know,
16 par fours and one par three and one par five. I just get bored to tears mm-hmm. with that. I like that variety. So I'm with you, 6, 6, and 6. All right, on to the next one here. We talked about the Masters a little bit. Will a past champion win the 2020 Masters? Now, I looked at this. There are 17 past champions in the field this week.
Three that probably have a shot.
probably, yeah.
Patrick Reed probably sadly has its best shot if that guy wins the Masters. If that would be, you know what? I'm going to bet money Patrick Reed wins the Masters. I'm saying yes, because that's 2020. Just completely, it's that person, that guy at the party that doesn't care. He's playing guitar in the corner. He's blasting his music. He's the drunkest person there. You know, he gets in a fight. That's 2020. And Patrick Reed is the end of the night when he's gotten now in a fight with the host. He's just coming here to not only just ruin the year completely, but, you know, make sure that we never have a party like this ever again. So you know what? I'm going to say, yeah, another one's going to win, and it's going to be Patrick Reed. And it's
I'm truly expecting a playoff between Bubba and Patrick. You know, something like that. You're right. Something weird is going to happen. Like I said, 17 with, I think, 90 players in the field. There's a good percentage that it could happen. So, yeah, I'll go with it and say it's not going to be a new winner. It's going to be a repeat winner. And actually, when I looked at that as well, something to know, when you look at the qualifying categories for all the players, Brooks Koepka is actually the player that is qualified in the most categories. He's actually eligible by 9 different categories to be in the Masters, whereas, you know, most of the other players, even a Tiger or whatever, might be 5 categories.
So. How about Sandy Lyle? How many categories?
1, Sandy past had. Champion. That is it.
How did Jimmy Walker get in here? Like this, like, did he make it to the Tour Championship or something in recent years?
I think he played okay last year. So
maybe that's it. But that's interesting. At 750-1, we're going to talk bets. Bernard Langer somehow has better odds than him, which is that's going to be tough.
That is funny. That has really got to be tough for your ego. All of a sudden, a guy that's 60 plus years old has got better odds.
But even that, like Nate Lashley's a young lad, and Bernard's got better odds than him as well. Max Homa getting in the Masters. Yeah, it's a decent field. I love the Masters. I can't wait.
I'm going to find out, actually. I'm curious about how Walker got in there. I'll have a look. He's under Category 4, which would be, he's a PGA champion. So he gets...
one more start? Is this his final one? Yeah.
Right. You get 5 years as a PGA champion. So that's how he got in there.
Sweet. All right. What else we got in the mailbag?
All right. On to 3 here. What are you looking forward to the most about this year's Masters? That's pretty vague.
Yeah. Well, we talked about it earlier. I like the idea of just being able to watch every shot. I think that's going to really show. And what it's going to do is it's going to bring out the true degenerate and anybody out there that's like, so I can watch every shot and bet on every single
shot. Exactly. And
my wife is going to be like, what are you doing? I'm going to lose $300. I'm in, right? I can't wait. I think it's going to be cool. It's going to be a different golf course. I think that's the thing. You're going to see different names in there. Will, Bryson, take over the golf course, right? You know, everyone saw he hit a 400 yard carry drive, wink wink, 20 wink, yards downwind,
41 yards left.
Exactly. I think if you have to pick, it's the ability to see every single shot, but I just can't wait to see, you know, the leaves a different color, and it's the best turn of the year for me. Outside of the Open Championship, which we've sadly lost, but they're different for me.
I think 1A, you know, we can't normally, well, sometimes we are playing in April when the Masters happens, but, you know, this is a Masters happening after the year is over. Yeah. So, you know, there's certainly no conflict here as well. I mean, you know, granted, obviously, you know, football is going to play a factor in there, but there's no hockey. So, you know, we're basically in a situation where the Masters is the star of the show. And I think, you know, it's a good time. At least April's usually pretty busy for me and doing other things. So this is a good time to basically park it on the couch for 4 days and really, you know, embrace it as much as possible. All right. If you could have a specific skill from a top pro golfer, what would it be?
Ooh. It's so easy now to pick. It's driving the golf ball.
Yeah.
Right. It's just the way the game's going. Right?
Is that from a distance standpoint?
I actually don't even know. I guess it's got to be distance, right? Yeah. You're going to make it work. You're going to score way lower. And for me, I think I putt decently enough that if I was able to drive the golf ball like that, I think I would be able to, you know, throw it in the 60s every once in a while, right? There's obviously other aspects of the game, but I just think it's the biggest thing right now is getting the ball way out there and in play.
Yeah, I think up to maybe this year, I would have probably taken somebody's iron game. It was generally the weakest part of my game, but it's something that I've worked on. So, you know, I would lean more to the driving side of it, more for accuracy. I've got enough length. I'm not worried about that, but it's hitting fairways and you know, putting yourself.
I don't have either.
Yeah, well, there you go.
So at least give me the distance. So
right. Yeah,
if I'm
going to
miss, at least I'm 50 yards down there. Sure. And, you know, I got a better shot at hitting the green.
Yeah, so I would definitely take the accuracy off the tee of a top pro golfer, and that's the one for me. All right, last one here. What's the acceptable etiquette on phone checks during a round of golf?
I don't care.
I know what you do. You don't.
I don't care. Like, check it if you want. I don't care. Yeah. Like, I don't. I won't take a call out there or anything like that. I usually have it in the cart if I have it, but I also keep I keep score on there. There's so many things you have on there. You know, who cares? I also can do without it for the whole round too. So it really depends. Like if I'm playing around, all I have is like a yardage book. I don't think you have I don't have the mental capacity to be going back and forth and looking at things. But I guess, yeah, who cares? Why does it need to have a number?
Yeah, I think this really comes down to probably where a person is playing. I don't know what their context is here. Maybe they have a situation. Maybe it's a corporate golf. Maybe they're playing with somebody where, you know, it's going to disturb their boss or a corporate client or whatever the case may be. I would say, you know, again, it doesn't really matter so much. Just be clear with the group that you're playing with. And you know, hey, maybe you've got an important call or an important email or something that's coming through, but you want to go and enjoy the game. You want to make sure that you're giving them your due attention. Let them know in advance. Hey, I've got a big email coming through. Don't mind me if I check the phone. You know, don't be rude. Don't be in the middle of the putting green, you know, taking a phone call or something like that or whatever. But hey, but that might be totally acceptable with the group that you play with. That's perfectly fine. But I think if it's just clear, whatever's acceptable within your group, that's perfectly fine from there. It's part of golf these days.
Yeah, I have more questions for the person asking it. Like, why do you care?
Probably.
Yeah. It's not just golf right now, and you know, we can go in the whole hoodie thing. And for the record, nobody cares about hoodies. No. So I don't know why
I'm waiting to see who's arguing on the other side.
I've never seen one argument on the other side. So, and I think this is the same thing. Like, if you are that person, you are the one person on the other side of hoodies. I don't get it. It makes no sense. Yeah. If you're the one that asked that question, I know those questions go to you, Scott. Send me a message. I want to know your thoughts. I need to get in your mind a little bit and understand this, because this makes no sense to me.
All right, there we go. All right, everyone, that's the mailbag for this week. Please keep sending your questions in. Love to get them in, and keep them coming. Get a hold of us on Instagram or Twitter, and we'll get to your questions every week.
Sounds good. All right, let's wrap it up with the tip of the week, Scott. I was talking about distance and wanting more distance and trading for the pro golfers. I feel like we're going to talk a little distance this week. What's the tip of the week?
Yeah, I got a lot of people talking about yardage, especially, you know, we've got the off season coming up. So a lot of people are saying, hey, I'm going to do a lot of training this winter. They're getting sort of that, you know, they're hearing all the stuff about Bryson. So they're like, oh, I'm going to get, you know, super speed out there, or Mach 3 system, and I'm going to work on speed, speed, speed. Well, you know what? Speed's not the only way that you get yardage. Some people have to realize that, you know, speed is important, but there's a lot of other factors that are important first. So they may want to concentrate on those first before they just try to develop club head speed. So don't start with just learning how to swing fast. You might be losing your yardage because of your contact, your path, your face angle of attack. There's a lot of other factors that are important first. And really, if you just gain more speed, you're probably just going to send the ball further offline. So it's not going to really help you a lot. So really make sure that you're blending in efficiency as well. So in those systems that I'm talking about, and I mentioned those specifically, Super Speed or Mach 3, these are these systems where you're swinging overweighted clubs and trying to overclock your speed and do all sorts of different things. The issue is that sometimes people will compromise
compromise what they're doing with their golf swing as far as the structure of their swing. So speed is important as far as club head speed is concerned, but ball speed is the really big important thing. And that comes from efficient contact with the golf ball. So focus on that as well. Not just your club head speed, ball speed is important. And that's the end thing in the end.
Fair enough. I like it. I'm looking forward to really overhauling the swing with you this winter. We've talked about that a lot. We talked about a lot of things on this podcast. We never do them. Like you carrying my golf bag from a bet you've
lost. My left hand around. I still haven't played.
Playing left-handed. Just kind of you failing to live up to your bets. So, I am going to live up to mine and overhaul my golf swing completely over the winter and really show how great of a coach you are. And I'm going to be your perfect marketing technique. Just like I was for Titleist with the new driver, right? 22 yards. And that's good. Well, you're going to be, I'm going to hold a sign up after and you're going to be, hey, just come look at this guy. Look at that swing.
He's a changed. Legend.
He's now way better. He's scoring one stroke lower after spending 80 hours a week working on his golf swing. It's amazing. That's it for us this week, folks. I said Masters coming up a couple weeks. We're going to talk a lot about that. I have a feeling I won't be watching any of the Bermuda Championship. Have you got it all on PVR ready to go?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, let's leave it there. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next week. We'll chat with you then. Some ocean and a day like today, my boat's lost in the ocean. Have another